This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
In the northern city of Abdera, on the Thracian coast of the Aegean, the wind from the sea carried more than the smell of fish and tar. It carried laughter. At least that is how later generations imagined it when they thought of Democritus, the philosopher who became known as the Laughing Thinker. While others frowned over the miseries of human life, Democritus was said to laugh at the vanity of human pursuits, not out of cruelty, but from a kind of cosmic detachment. Whether this picture is literally accurate hardly matters. It captures something true about his philosophy. He invites us to see the world and ourselves from a standpoint so vast that our anxieties begin to look small. To reach that standpoint, he offers a bold, almost shocking claim: everything that exists is either atoms or void. Democritus was born around 460 BCE in Abdera, a relatively marginal Greek city compared to Athens or Corinth. Abdera had a reputation among other Greeks as a somewhat backward provincial place, a target for jokes. That the most radical physical theory of antiquity should arise from there is one of history's quiet ironies. Democritus traveled widely in his youth, if we can trust later reports, to Egypt to learn geometry, to the east to study with magi, across the Greek world absorbing local knowledge. However embroidered those tales may be, they convey the sense of a man with a wide horizon, dissatisfied with confining his thought to the customs of a single city. He inherited the project of natural philosophy from the earlier Ionians and from Leucippus, the shadowy figure often credited with founding atomism. Some even say Democritus was Leucippus's student. Little is known for certain about Leucippus, but the fundamental idea that Democritus develops is clear enough. Where Anaxagoras had said everything is in everything, and Empedocles had posited four roots mixing and separating, Democritus and his school take a more austere path. They deny that matter is infinitely divisible in the sense of being endlessly cut into pieces that are still of the same kind. Instead, they posit that if you keep dividing bodies, you eventually reach units that can be divided no further. These are atoms, from atomos, uncuttable. The atoms, he says, are infinite in number and of infinite variety in shape and size, but they share certain basic features. Each atom is utterly solid, without internal gaps, homogeneous through and through. They have no color, taste, or smell. Those sensible qualities arise only in the combinations of atoms and in their interactions with our organs. Atoms, in themselves, have only size, shape, and position, and they move in the void, the empty space that is just as real as the atoms themselves. Thus, the world consists of what is, the atoms, and what is not, the void. Democritus dares to rehabilitate non-being as something necessary. Not Parmenides' absolute nothing, but emptiness, the absence of body that makes motion possible. Picture the early Greek imagination of space before atomism. For Parmenides, there could be no true void, because that would be what is not, and to speak of it as if it were something is already to contradict oneself. For Empedocles and Anaxagoras, the world is densely packed with stuffs and seeds. Democritus, by contrast, insists that without empty space, motion would be impossible. If everything were solidly full, no body could move without displacing another, which would displace another, in an infinite regress of compression. Instead, he imagines atoms of various shapes drifting, colliding, hooking together, or bouncing apart in the void, like dust motes in a beam of light. That image, tiny bodies in empty space, will fascinate philosophers and scientists 2 millennia later, when physics finally acquires the tools to model such behavior quantitatively. For Democritus, the bewildering variety of the visible world is a matter of arrangement. Different kinds of atoms, with hooks, eyes, barbs, or smoothness, combine into clusters. The cluster structure determines how it behaves at our scale. Something hard and solid, like iron, is composed of atoms that are closely packed and interlocked. Something fluid, like water, has atoms that are smoother and more mobile, able to slide past one another. Air consists of even finer, more agile atoms. Fire is made of the most rapid, sharpest atoms capable of penetrating other bodies. There are no inherent fire stuffs or water stuffs, distinct in kind from others. There are only atoms arranged in certain ways, moving at certain speeds. This view radically undermines the world of everyday qualities: sweetness, bitterness, warmth, color, sound. All the things that most immediately fill our experience are, Democritus says, not in the objects themselves in any robust sense. They are effects produced in us when atoms in external bodies interact with our senses. In a famous fragment, he has the senses accuse the mind. Wretched mind, you take your evidence from us and then seek to overthrow us? Our overthrow is your overthrow. The mind, using reason, corrects the senses by arguing that color, taste, and so on exist only by convention, while in reality there are only atoms and void. But the mind can only reach this conclusion because it has first received input from the senses. There is a tension here that will echo through later philosophy. The senses are both indispensable and unreliable. Democritus's atomism is not an armchair fantasy. It is meant to explain concrete phenomena. Why does heat rise? Because the atoms that constitute what we call fire are lighter, more mobile, and tend to move upward when less constrained. Why does smell diffuse through air? Because minute clusters of atoms detach from the smelled object and spread out, eventually reaching our nostrils. Why does a cut heal? Because the atoms of flesh in the surrounding area rearrange and fill the gap. Why do things wear out? Because atoms detach over time under the impact of other atoms. Each explanation uses the same vocabulary: shape, size, motion, collision. There is no need to invoke hidden sympathies, divine whims, or souls animating natural objects. For Democritus, even the soul is composed of atoms, though of a fine and special kind. He calls soul atoms fire-like, particularly subtle, swift, and spherical. They permeate the body and are responsible for life, sensation, and thought. When you breathe, you take in new soul atoms from the air, which replace those lost and keep the organism alive. When you die, the soul atoms disperse. There is no eternal, immaterial soul that survives as a personal self. The compounds dissolve, the atoms move on. In this, Democritus is a thoroughgoing materialist. There is nothing over and above the atoms and their arrangements. Gods, too, if they exist, must be composed of atoms. He sometimes speaks of long-lived, cosmic beings inhabiting the spaces between worlds, but these are not creators or moral judges. They are natural phenomena. If you stop here, Democritus can seem like a cold engineer of the universe, draining it of warmth and meaning. But his ethical writings, though surviving only in fragments, show a different side. He was intensely interested in human flourishing. He wrote on cheerfulness, moderation, friendship, anger, fear, and the good life. For him, ethics is not a separate domain insulated from physics. It is rather the art of living well once one understands the true nature of things. Since everything happens by the necessary motions of atoms, Democritus does not think of human life as the object of divine reward or punishment. There is no afterlife in which injustices are balanced out, no cosmic ledger that keeps track of each person's deeds. This could lead to pessimism or nihilism. If nothing ultimately matters in a cosmic sense, why bother striding for goodness? Democritus' answer is subtle. He shifts the focus from cosmic consequences to the inner state of the person. The goal of life, he suggests, is euthymia, a stable cheerfulness or tranquility of soul. This is not crude pleasure-seeking. Rather, it is a condition in which desires are moderated, fears are calmed, and the mind is in harmony with itself and with the way things are. He writes that the best life is not found in the pursuit of luxury, fame, or political power, because those things depend on external circumstances and are of their nature unstable. To grasp for them is to put one's peace in the hands of chance and the opinions of others. Instead, we should cultivate a measured character, taking joy in modest, natural pleasures and in the quiet satisfaction of understanding. Knowledge itself is a source of delight. To contemplate the order of the world, even if that order is nothing but atoms and void, is to participate in something larger than our personal concerns. Democritus often contrasts the wise person with the foolish. The wise person, he says, is guided by reason, accepts the limits of human power, and adjusts his or her expectations accordingly. The foolish person chases illusions, overestimates his control, and is constantly disturbed by disappointments. In one fragment, he remarks that people are more likely to become good if they see others being honored for goodness and punished for its opposite. Yet, he also insists that true goodness is its own reward. The soul of the just is calm, while the soul of the unjust is agitated, full of fear and suspicion. In the absence of a divine judge, conscience itself becomes the primary tribunal. This ethical outlook connects back to atomism in a deeper way. If everything is atoms in motion, including us, then we are not the center of the universe. Our joys and sorrows, our victories and defeats, are local rearrangements in a vast, indifferent process. To see this clearly could be crushing, but Democritus turns it into a source of liberation. If the world does not revolve around us, if the gods are not poised to reward or punish us according to inscrutable plans, then a heavy burden falls away. We are free to direct our care toward what is within our reach. The cultivation of character, the shaping of our small sphere of action. He writes that happiness resides not in flocks and gold. The soul is the dwelling of the daemon. The daemon here is not necessarily a separate entity. It is the character, the inner configuration of the person. Wealth, status, and bodily pleasures are all subject to the buffetings of fortune. But the disposition one cultivates through reflection and habit can become a relatively stable island of order in the flux. That order, in the Democritean view, is itself a certain pattern of atoms in the soul. There is no gulf between material and spiritual states. To become wiser, more moderate, more just, is to reshape the pattern of soul atoms in a more harmonious way. This way of thinking will echo in later Hellenistic schools, especially Epicureanism. Epicurus, who lived almost a century later, adopted and adapted Democritus's atomism, modifying some details, but preserving the basic insight that everything is atoms in the void, and that the good life is one of tranquil pleasure and freedom from fear. Where Democritus had hinted at these ethical themes without building a full system, Epicurus constructed a deliberate way of life around them. Stoics, too, though may rejected atomism in favor of a continuum of divine fire, shared Democritus's emphasis on inner disposition over external circumstance. One of the most striking features of Democritus's ethics is his focus on self-knowledge and self-correction. He suggests that we should be more shamed before ourselves than before others when we contemplate doing wrong. Public shame can be avoided by secrecy. Inner shame cannot be so easily escaped. Even if there is no God watching, we watch ourselves. This anticipates later introspective traditions that see conscience as a kind of internalized gaze, a witness we carry with us everywhere. At the same time, Democritus is not a solitary moralist. He sees humans as fundamentally social. Friendship, he says, is one of their greatest goods, and a city where citizens are willing to die for one another is better than a city full of wealth but lacking loyalty. He cautions against anger and harshness, noting that they disturb the soul and damage relationships. He advises moderation in all things, not as a concession to weakness, but as a path to durable contentment. The tension between the severely impersonal physics and the gently humane ethics in Democritus has fascinated interpreters. How can a worldview that reduces everything to atoms and void still leave room for values like justice, friendship, and wisdom? One answer is that these values are not out there, in the fabric of the cosmos, in the way atoms and void are, but in here, in the patterns of human life. Democritus does not seek to ground ethics in metaphysics by saying that the universe is morally structured. Instead, he grounds it in the facts of human psychology. Certain ways of living lead to peace of soul and flourishing communities. Others lead to turmoil and conflict. Even if the universe is indifferent, we are not. We care, and our caring itself is one of the complex patterns that has emerged from the motions of atoms. At a deeper level, though, there may be more unity than first appears. Democritus's delight in understanding, his laughter at human folly, his insistence on moderation, all reflect a single stance, the stance of someone who has stepped back far enough from the immediate scene to see patterns. The same capacity that allows him to imagine invisible atoms combining and separating also allows him to see that human pursuits for glory and wealth often end in misery. The same intellectual humility that recognizes our senses can be fooled leads him to suspect that our appetites can be misdirected. In both physics and ethics, the task is to distinguish appearance from reality, to avoid being enslaved by what merely seems important. Democritus is also significant for your story of Western moral philosophy because he represents a clear early articulation of what will later be called a secular outlook. He does not deny the existence of gods outright, but he strips them of their central place in explaining the world or grounding morality. The cosmos, in his view, was not made for us. It has no ultimate purpose. Worlds are formed and destroyed in an endless dance of atoms, without final goal. There is no providence ensuring that virtue will be rewarded and vice punished. No final judgment in which accounts are settled. Yet he does not sink into despair. Instead, he takes that very lack of cosmic moral structure as a challenge. Can we, finite, contingent beings, carve out a sphere of meaning and goodness anyway? His answer is yes, and the tool he offers is philosophy itself. The love of wisdom, he suggests, is not an escape from the world, but a way of inhabiting it more lucidly. By understanding nature, we free ourselves from superstitious fears. By understanding ourselves, we can reshape our character. By understanding others, we can build bonds that make life more bearable. In this sense, Democritus stands at the root of a long tradition in which philosophy is not just a theoretical enterprise, but a way of life, a practice of mental and emotional discipline aimed at freedom. There is a certain poignancy in the fact that none of Democritus's many books, he reportedly wrote dozens, on ethics, mathematics, music, and more, survive in full. We know him only through later quotations and reports, often by hostile or superior-minded authors. Plato, for example, never mentions him by name, even though he must have known of his work, perhaps because he found atomism too threatening to acknowledge. Aristotle engages with atomistic ideas, but prefers the continuity of his own hylomorphic physics. It was left to Epicurus, and much later, to Roman writers like Lucretius to carry the Democritean torch. Still, the fragments are enough to let us glimpse the outline of a remarkable mind. We see a man who can say, with disarming simplicity, by convention sweet, by convention bitter, by convention hot, by convention cold, by convention color, in reality, atoms and void. And who could also say, it is better to be wronged than to do wrong, because wrongdoing deforms the soul's inner order. A thinker who can imagine invisible particles moving in a vast empty space, and who can also counsel ordinary people to avoid excessive grief, because death is natural and inevitable. To feel the full force of Democritus's position, it helps to place him alongside some of his near contemporaries. In Athens, where sophists like Protagoras were teaching rhetoric and practical wisdom for civic life, the human world was at the center of attention. Protagoras could say, "Man is the measure of all things," meaning that what appears to us as true or just is in some sense the standard. Democritus, by contrast, makes the human measure small against the backdrop of an immense, indifferent universe. He does not deny the importance of human affairs for us, but he refuses to make them the yardstick of reality. In this way, he balances, within one generation, a tension that will run through Western thought. Is philosophy primarily about helping us navigate the city, the courtroom, the household, or is it about understanding the structure of the whole? Socrates and Plato will tilt the answer back toward the human, asking what justice is, what the good life is, how the soul should be ordered, yet even they cannot ignore the questions Democritus has raised about the nature of the physical world. Plato in the Timaeus offers a cosmology in which a divine craftsman shapes matter according to eternal forms, partly in response to atomistic views. He wants a universe that is not only intelligible, but purposive, ordered for the best. Democritus' cosmos, by contrast, has no craftsman, no overarching purpose. Patterns emerge from the blind play of atoms. For Plato, this seems impoverished. It leaves no ultimate reason why things should be as they are. For Democritus, it is simply honest. Aristotle, more empirically minded, has his own quarrels with atomism. He doubts the existence of the void, arguing that nature abhors a vacuum. He rejects indivisible atoms, preferring to think in terms of continuous matter that can always be divided further in thought, if not in practice. Yet he shares with Democritus a commitment to explaining natural phenomena without recourse to arbitrary divine interventions. His four causes, material, formal, efficient, and final, are an attempt to provide a richer explanatory framework than atoms and void alone can offer. Where Democritus emphasizes the material and efficient causes, what things are made of and how they push and pull on one another, Aristotle insists we also need to know the form and the end, what a thing is and what it is for. From a later vantage, one can see that both approaches capture something important. Democritus grasps the power of simple mechanical explanation, which will become central in modern science. Aristotle grasps the importance of organization and function, which will remain crucial in biology and in understanding systems. Their disagreement is less a simple right or wrong, and more a difference of emphasis. But in the moral sphere, Democritus's sheer refusal to anchor ethics in cosmic purposes creates a distinctive space. It makes it possible to think about goodness, justice, and happiness without assuming that the universe is secretly on our side. Centuries later, when the Roman poet Lucretius set out to write his long poem On the Nature of Things, he chose Democritean atomism, as refined by Epicurus, as the backbone of his message. The poem is not only a physics lesson, but a therapeutic work. Lucretius wants to free his readers from fear of the gods and of death. He describes the endless reign of atoms, the formation and dissolution of worlds, the mortality of the soul. He insists that there is no torment after death, that hell and divine wrath are human inventions. The tone is urgent, compassionate, and sometimes ecstatic. Echoing Democritus across the centuries, he presents the understanding of nature as a kind of spiritual liberation. To know that everything is atoms and void is not to sink into despair, he argues, but to be released from terror and allowed to enjoy the finite goods actually available. In the modern period, when scientists like Gassendi, Boyle, and later Dalton revived and refined atomistic ideas, they often explicitly invoked Democritus. He became a symbol of clear-eyed naturalism, someone who had glimpsed, with primitive tools, a structure of matter that later experiments would confirm in astonishing detail. His name appears in textbooks and histories as a forerunner, as if his primary significance lay in anticipating modern chemistry and physics. Yet if we focus only on that, we miss the lived ethical project behind his thought. For Democritus, physics and ethics are interwoven. The same temperament that prefers simple, intelligible explanations over myth favors a life of simplicity over ostentation. The same readiness to accept that the world is not built around human wishes translates into a kind of modesty in personal ambition. He does not tell us to reject pleasure. He warns us against being enslaved by it. He does not tell us to withdraw from society. He counsels us to value genuine friendship over the applause of the crowd. There is a thread of gentleness in his fragments, a sense that harshness toward others rebounds on the soul of the harsh person. We can imagine him in old age, walking the dusty streets of Abdera, or perhaps sitting outside the city, looking out to sea. News would come of wars among the great cities, of shifting alliances, of the rise and fall of tyrants. From time to time, a traveler might bring word of new doctrines being preached in Athens, of Socrates questioning young men in the marketplace, of sophists dazzling audiences with skillful speeches. Democritus, listening, might smile. He would know that in 100 years, most of these names would be forgotten by ordinary people, that the atoms composing statues and trophies and public buildings would have rearranged themselves many times over. The scale of his imagination made the politics of the day look both real and small. Yet he would also know that within that smallness, everything of human importance happens. The decision of a father to treat his children with kindness or cruelty, the choice of a magistrate to accept a bribe or to stand firm, the effort of a citizen to educate herself rather than drift. These are not trivial just because the cosmos is vast. They shape the texture of lived experience, which is the only domain in which words like good and bad have purchase. The atoms do not care, but we do, and our caring is itself one of the complex patterns that have emerged in this corner of the universe. In this way, Democritus' thought anticipates a modern tension. Many people today accept, at least in outline, a picture of the world in which humans are small, the cosmos is old, and there is no obvious built-in moral order. The question then arises, how can we live meaningfully in such a world? Some answer by reasserting religious frameworks that restore cosmic purpose. Others answer by embracing a kind of heroic nihilism, insisting that there is no meaning and that we must create what little we can. Democritus offers a third path. Without promising grand destinies or transcendent guarantees, he suggests that clarity, moderation, friendship, and curiosity are enough to sustain a good life. His universe does not promise to remember us, but it does offer us the chance, for a while, to be awake within it. If one listens carefully, there is even a hint of gratitude in his attitude. To exist at all, in a world where worlds are constantly forming and dissolving, is already remarkable. To be a creature who can not only feel pleasure and pain, but also ask why things are as they are, is rarer still. Democritus' laughter, in the best interpretation, is not contempt, but a kind of astonished amusement that beings, as fragile and brief as we are, take ourselves so seriously, while at the same time ignoring the one seriousness that matters, the shape of our own souls. This is why, in a series on Western moral philosophy, Democritus deserves more than a passing mention as the atomist before Epicurus. He represents an early, lucid attempt to hold together two insights: that the world can be understood without recourse to gods or purposes, and that a life of integrity and kindness is still worth living. He does not derive the latter from the former in a tight argument. He lives them side by side as two aspects of the same fundamental stance, a refusal to lie either about the structure of nature or about what makes a human life go well. From that vantage, the laughing philosopher of Abdera is not mocking us cruelly. He is laughing at the way we torment ourselves by treating what is fragile and contingent as if it were absolute. He is inviting us to join him in a kind of lightness, not of frivolity, but of perspective. The world is atoms and void, yes, but it is also, for now, the only theater in which justice, friendship, and joy can play out. To understand its underlying structure is not to drain it of value, but to locate our values where they can actually live, in the patterns of our own lives, fragile, temporary, and all the more precious for that fragility.
Midnight rails under silver moon, dusty boots on a winding road. A shadow's the only friend I've known since she packed up and let me go. Empty whiskey bottle on the sea, her laugh still echoes in my bones. Saddle's heavy with memories, I ride alone where the wind still blows. Nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be. Sunrise paints the horizon gold, but it don't warm a lonesome soul. Every town I pass feels half her size. Every trail's haunted by goodbye. I whisper prayers to open skies, hoping someday my heart'll find a brand new path beyond the pain where broken hearts can heal in time. Nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be.
Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be.